some lenders in the bridging space who are doing bridging loans to, you know, people's individual names who only own one asset. I think you've got to be very careful of what pain could be around the corner. One thing I've always preferred doing is dealing with lenders who at least have principal equity in deals.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, A, there's very little care. And B, you know, you don't really deal with a decision maker, or you're not dealing even with a business that is the decision maker.
Welcome to the Property Funder podcast. I'm here with Callum Taylor again for part two of our conversation. It's good to have you here, Callum. Before we went away, before we went and ended part one, we were talking about working from home. It's a Friday today. I don't know if you've noticed it, but my emails have been surprisingly quiet. My WhatsApps, my phone has been surprisingly quiet. You know, I know you said you don't mind if people work from home too much, but I mean, but obviously there's a key benefit of being in the office. Do you think Fridays become like not even a half day in this country? Like, it's ridiculous, no?
Yeah. I think, you know, I could be on the golf course on a Friday afternoon and you pretty much guarantee you won't get a phone call or an email. But I also think, you know, on our policy on working from home, I'm happy for people to work from home, but one day a week. I always find it scary when someone says that day, I want that day to be a Monday or a Friday, because, you know, what does Monday and Friday tie into?
Long weekends.
interesting one, that. And you know, working from home doesn't mean it gives you an opportunity to hang up your laundry. It doesn't mean it gives you an opportunity to do any of those things that you wouldn't be able to do in an office. It, you know, really should just mean that you don't have to travel to work. And maybe you just need a bit of peace and you can get some admin stuff done. So I think there certainly is positives to it. Like, I find when I work from home in the evenings, I probably can do in 2 or 3 hours what I can probably do in a whole day. But I think, especially in our industry, looking at Fridays should be the day you're in the office most of the time, because Friday's the day completions happen.
That's the day that deals get done, right?
Like, so I don't know if you've found, like I have, I can't remember figuratively speaking, you know, deals don't feel like they happen on Fridays anymore.
No.
People feel like they pretend to get deals on a Friday and they'll happen on Monday, or they'll rush to get it done on a Thursday.
Yeah.
And it just seems a little bit backwards.
Mm. I mean, what do you think of this sort of this move to 4 day weeks, 4 day working weeks for some companies?
It's absolutely nuts. I think, maybe, you know, there's maybe some excuses and there's some instances where it makes sense, but, you know, in a service-led business, you know, some people might only want to talk about their mortgage on a weekend. They might not be able to talk about their mortgage Monday to Friday. So, you know, if you get rid of another day for them, you know, it just, you know, it, I mean, I wouldn't mind if everyone else does it, because we won't do it, and it's would be opportunity, but it's all a bit crazy.
Yeah. I think the worst thing is that people expect 5 day a week wages for effectively working the best part of 4 and a quarter. You know, like, you know, you're getting at best, what I worry about is that you get at best an hour or two's worth of work out of someone on a Friday. I mean, you even had some companies in the States who said in the summer, well, basically just take Friday afternoon off.
Yeah.
Because it was almost like they were waving the white flag.
Yeah, no. My partner's business, she worked for American-based business, they did the same. Summer was Friday half days. But again, I think it's hard because they've obviously adopted that rule, because it's an American-based business. But in America, you have a hell of a lot less holiday.
Yeah.
You have, you know, there's quite a lot of national holidays and stuff like that, bank holidays. But there's not, you know, they don't get 25, 30 or 35 days that, you know, people who've been at a business a long time, whatever your incentives might be, get.
Like you do in Europe. Yeah, I guess that's an interesting dynamic. But the problem is that if that comes over here, you know, when you're already getting the best part of, you know, a week's holiday every other month, and then you start effectively saying, well, all right, well, one, you know, effectively half of 1 day a week on top of that, you know, you can take that off. And it just becomes a bit of a slippery slope, doesn't it?
And it does.
So I think it's something that it's interesting. What do you make of these? A lot of these big banks now calling their staff into the office 5 days a week, full time.
I think the hard thing is that businesses, it's even harder than ever to make bottom line.
Yeah.
Right. You've got all these costs going up. You've got the government asking people, you know, businesses to put their hands in their pockets. And businesses are probably looking at it and going, well, okay, is this as efficient as we can be? And the answer most likely is no. So, you know, what's the first thing you're going to do? The first thing to do is to make sure your efficiency is as good as it can be. You know, I personally would rather pay someone within my business more to do 1.5 people's roles because they're a hard worker,
yeah,
than have 3 people doing, you know, 2 people's roles because they're working from home 2 days a week. And I think, you know, there's a, it's hard for me to say it because I'd say, you know, I'm young enough to be classed as some sort of, we were talking about this earlier, I'm not sure what Gen I am.
Are you a Gen Z or are you a millennial?
Don't have to tell me.
What year were you born in?
93.
You were just about a millennial.
Just about a millennial.
Yeah.
But there is certainly a culture of, we, you know, you don't need to work as hard anymore. You know, people can't tell you what to do. People, you know, you've got all these things that you should be allowed. You know, what can this business do for me? Rather than the attitude of what can I do for them?
There's Elon Musk was tweeting, as he does, and always posting on X, and with his sort of Doge, Department of Government Efficiency hat on. And he said that less than half of all federal buildings in the US are occupied at the moment. Because everyone who working for the US government is working from home. And I think he's calling for mandatory, basically a mandatory like office working for the employees. There was a part of me that I was debating with a few friends. There's a part of me think it's actually very smart because I don't know if you know, if you would agree with this stat. I mean, there's probably, I would estimate in most businesses, 20% of the people do 80% of the work.
Yep.
And I imagine he's sort of thinking a bit like how he did with when he bought X or Twitter as it was at the time. He's thinking, right, if I call everyone, if we force or mandate federal employees back into the office, into the workplace, what it will do is that the ones that need the jobs or the ones that are willing to do the work, actually continue to do the work, will stay, and then the people who aren't committed will go and will actually leave voluntarily, and then they'll end up having to be able to save a huge amount of
cleansing tactic.
It's a cleansing tactic, right? I mean, I don't, and I imagine actually with some of these investment banks that are calling people back, you know, Goldman famously would cut the bottom 10 or 20% of all of their staff every year. It's kind of a similar filter, isn't it? Where it's an opportunity to move people on who maybe aren't as focused or committed.
I worry, you know, you talk about, you know, if we start talking about AI and can technology take over what people are doing?
Yeah.
I think certainly, you know, there is a huge number of roles within businesses, you know, especially talking about federal government level like you are, that they probably can. Is there enough fight if you choose the right person? I don't think technology can replace them because they have intrinsic value. They have a quality that can't be represented by an email or a robot or whatever it might be. I think it's an interesting one. I also think from our point of view of a property aspect, you know, what's that mentality done for, you know, the city? Values, rents have gone down, therefore, you know, yields have gone down, values have gone down. I think there's this opinion of lots of people that, you know, all of these offices in London are all owned by extremely wealthy people and it make no difference to them. You know, they'll still be able to buy their house in Miami, St. Bart's, and, you know, go up to their holiday home, etc. But I think there's a lot of people that they don't realize that we see on our basis that are just about making these deals work.
Yeah. But they also forget there's pension, a lot of times pension funds or people's pensions are actually investing in these buildings as well, right? Yeah. So there's, you know, there's a thing that there's an indirect impact on people that they don't actually fully appreciate. Yeah,
correct.
Yeah,
it's an interesting one. And then we can talk about the triple lock, but
yeah, you know, well, let's not go there. I mean, you were talking, you were talking to me offline about it being more difficult than ever to start a business, and particularly as a young entrepreneur. I mean, what, you know, can you speak to that in any way? Like, where do, you know, how do you see that?
Yeah, I think, look, I've heard you speaking with another guest on the show, and you were talking about how, you know, the concern of young people and adults, you know, the amount of screen time, all that sort of thing. I know this sounds like it's not connected, but I'll get there. I'll draw the dots in the end.
You can weave your way there. Yeah, yeah.
I'll get there. I was lucky that, you know, I was probably just out that mobile phone era of, like, anyway, a phone that's like amazingly good at doing everything. Got apps. I think the iPhone came out when I was probably 15 or something.
Right. Okay.
So it, you know, it wasn't quite there. It was still phone calls still existed. And I think without that ability to be a people person that you learn at a very young age, being an entrepreneur is very difficult. And then you start factoring in the cost to run a business, you know, the government coming to us business owners and saying, look, unfortunately, you guys are the ones that are going to put your hands in your pockets. It's tough to see it in this environment that it's not encouraging people. You know, there's certain world leaders, I think, that are very business, you know, the more success your business has, the more people you're going to employ, that will float down, you know, trickle down the ladder, and everyone else underneath that ladder will benefit, whether that person's spending more, you know, something as simple as spending more money in the corner shop because they're doing better for you, or, you know, moving up the housing ladder and freeing up more housing for someone else. I think there's a lot of barriers in place that make it very difficult to start a business now. And to enjoy running one, it's, you know, it's no beating around the bush. It's hard work. It's tough.
This episode is brought to you by J3 Advisory. J3 understands the unique insurance challenges that lenders face and are committed to providing solutions that offer peace of mind and financial security. Their expert advice helps you make better, faster decisions about your insurance program. Interested in a CPD session to update your teams on the current insurance landscape, or need precise and practical insurance advice for live schemes? Get in touch with J3 Advisory. Learn more at j3advisory.co.uk. J3 Advisory is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. I think one of the things that's not being talked about enough yet, because obviously we've got the increase in employers' NI, and we were talking offline about Sainsbury's announced that they're going to cut 3,000 jobs, which is really significant, actually. I mean, and these are not people who are, these are people who are kind of, you know, at the bottom rung of society, a lot of them, you know, the entry-level jobs don't require much in the way of qualifications. And this is a function of the fact that you don't need, you know, employers are looking at that. I think it's going to cost Sainsbury's £130 million extra a year in off their bottom line, and so companies are therefore incentivized to not employ as many people.
100%.
But I think the next thing that we have to start thinking about is that, right, you're an entrepreneur, you've got a growing business, you're looking to hire people, particularly young people. Sometimes those hires don't work out because, you know, they don't have the right personality, they don't have the right mindset, you know, fill in the blank. We're in a similar position, obviously a little bit bigger in terms of headcount, but, you know, like, you know, SME and SME owner, right? If that employee doesn't work out right now, you have got up to 2 years that you can say, look, sorry, John, Jemima, whatever you call yourself, it's not working out. I'm really sorry. We're just going to have to let you go. All right. You don't have to follow any process. You don't have to have any cause for that, right? Invariably, you know, and that has made the UK a very, very attractive place to do business for international companies, because, you know, there's an old saying, there's a saying that I read online, which is never follow the British form of British way of funding healthcare, never follow French employment practices. Well, what the government's planning to do is we've already got the NHS, so we're already kind of screwed there, and then we're about to follow kind of French/German. Employment laws, right? And so all of a sudden people have day one employment rights, which means you have to then, you know, like, so you're gonna have to be much more selective about how you hire people. So consequently, if you don't need to have people in the UK, you can get a workforce in South Africa that speaks, that's on the same time zone, speaks perfect English because they're effectively native. Or you can do that in India, or you can do it in the Philippines or wherever. But it doesn't, a lot of these functions don't have to be in the UK. It almost feels, you know, it feels incredibly dangerous for, you know, for the wider UK economy.
I think as well is that they're not looking at, you know, what's the best for that person. They yeah. think what the best for that person is allowing them to keep their job and allowing them to, you know, stay in a job, stay with pay, etc. But sometimes what's good for someone is working out that this is not the right job for them.
Yeah.
Whatever that industry might be, which is very hard to do when you're basically going to, you know, keep them around just to try and, you know, tick a box and what yeah. have you. But I think the incredibly frustrating thing is, you know, you look at it, and I think people have this perception, certainly this government looks like they have this perception of, well, if business owners make more money, they're just going to go and take that money and, you know, they get richer and everyone else gets, you know, poorer. But I think if you really look at, especially SME businesses, businesses that are trying to grow, you know, if we make more money this year, I'm only going to invest that money in the business.
Exactly.
I'm not going to go and take that off the table. And so you look at business like Sainsbury's, you know, they're laying off those jobs. You know, it was obvious. You could have taught a six-year-old that people weren't just going to accept the tax rises. They've got shareholders. They've got people they've got to answer to.
And those shareholders aren't fat. Again, they're not fat cats.
Correct.
They're pension funds. These mm-hmm. are people's pensions. That, yeah. You know.
Or some little old lady who bought some, you know, 100 Sainsbury's shares however many years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and that's her, that might be her kid's inheritance. Or, you know, that's a smaller, whatever yeah. it might be. So, you know, they're going to want their institution they've invested in to do the best with, you know, their money. You wouldn't want to put your money in the bank and then hear that they're just starting to give it away.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think, you know, it's incredibly short-sighted and stupid to think that business owners are just going to suck up, you know, just suck up the costs because they can't afford to do so. The economy is not strong enough to allow that. And also the understanding that we will reinvest that money. You know, the better my business does, the more people I'll hire, which will then in turn create more, you know, wealth, more, you know, tax for everyone else and can benefit all these things that they're trying to do. I was listening to the radio the other day and they were talking about unemployment figures and the number of vacancies available and the number of people in payroll jobs. And all the figures had gone in the wrong direction, to which is what you can expect,
yeah.
You know. And then we can start talking about, you know, driving people out of the country. You know, people, how many people I know? 5 years ago, I didn't know anyone who'd moved to Dubai or Portugal.
And now everyone's talking about it.
And now I know multiple people who've either done it or are talking about it. And you just think, how does this start to make sense?
Mm.
You know, look after your own first.
Because we're driving away these wealth creators, the people who pay the tax.
100%.
They're being driven away.
You know, if my son was got to 18 and said, I'm going to set up this business and I thought it was a good idea, I'd say, first of all, go and, you know, register it. Go and register it offshore and go and, you know, do whatever. And you might have to run the business here, but it doesn't make sense to do it here anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure a lot can change by then, but yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, we had this week was the inauguration of President Trump. I know you're a fan. Do you look enviously at the US right now from a business point of view? You know, do you sort of look at that and think that of what might have been or what the opportunity we might have if we followed a similar path politically?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, he's, you know, people, it's very hard. People say, you know, you can't like the guy, you can't support the guy, you can't do this, that, and the other. But there is a way that you can agree with certain people's things they believe in, but also still think that he's a moron and that he, you know, tweets ridiculous stuff. And the stuff he says just sounds insane when it comes out of his mouth. But when you actually look at the kind of bottom line, yes, I would much prefer to be a business owner with him as the leader of the country than the current setup we have. I think every business owner you ask would, depends what sector I suppose, but certainly say the same thing. I know a couple of guys, you know, I spent a fair bit of time in America and I know a couple of guys who run businesses there and they say, hate the guy, but voted for him because it's the best thing for me and my family, and it's the best thing for people I employ.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can simultaneously disagree with lots of things that he says, but then also look at, but you also have to acknowledge the stuff that he gets right. And I think, you know, for sure, you know, he, like, for example, you know, if you want to have low inflation, if you want to have a manufacturing sector that works, you need to have cheap energy. Unfortunately, to have cheap energy, you've got to have, you have to allow for some form of hydrocarbon strategy in that, as well as nuclear and all the renewable stuff. Otherwise you're forcing yourself into a really negative position. Now, as the owner of wind turbines in this country, I could say very selfishly,
you've got some, dude.
Not me own my own, but it's a family
in the garden.
Yeah, exactly. on my brother's farm, I might add. You know, you could say selfishly, oh well, actually, it really suits me because high energy prices benefit us. But you know, I also own other businesses. I own commercial real estate. We need to think about what's best for the country and the economy as a whole, right? You as a commercial mortgage broker, and residential mortgage broker, you want to see a strong buzzing economy because you want clients to be buying stuff and turning assets and growing and developing. At the moment, it sort of feels like that's all going a little bit backwards. I mean, look, maybe there's some green shoots that I'm missing. Maybe there's, you can give me some cause for optimism. But at the moment, I'm kind of struggling.
Yeah, I think, look, this is one thing, do I agree that the NHS needs more funding? Yes. Do I agree that...
I don't agree with that.
Certain things in certain places do need more money, that whatever it might be. Yes, there's certain things I agree with. But I think someone sent me this very, you spend your life scrolling through random reels on Instagram and stuff. Somebody sent me this thing, and it was the contrast between, I think you find it actually, I think it was on GB News or whatever, and it was Keir Starmer's first speech as Prime Minister, and it starts with tough times ahead.
Yeah.
Where this is going to hurt, this is that and the other. And whether that be the truth or not, there's surely, the leader, the manager of a football team doesn't come out and say, we're shit.
Yeah.
This is going to be tough today because they're a lot better than you and you're crap. So just, get on with it. And then to looking at Donald Trump, who of course the country has loads of problems and he could have been negative. He starts by saying, whatever he said, I'm back.
Yeah.
This is, going to be the greatest 4 years in America, whatever. And whether you believe it is or isn't, at least it's trying to be positive. I feel like there's a lot of, negative energy of, there's not, people aren't, don't enjoy other people being successful anymore.
I don't think, I think there's this concept in the UK of sort of tall poppy syndrome that I think Australians suffer from it as well. But, it's like we hate to see people being successful and we don't celebrate each other's successes. Mm. There's this sort of desire to knock people down, and which I think that mindset and mentality in the States is completely the opposite. If you've had a failure, it's almost like, everyone has to have a failure because it's just part of the journey, part of the success. Whereas if you have one failure, it's the only thing people ever, or you do one thing wrong in your life, it's the only thing people actually ever talk about you in public discourse. And it's like, well, that's not how we move forward. We need to be positive.
Yeah. We must have gone wrong somewhere, right? I mean, America's the largest economy in the world. It's got the most, there's loads of stats that are positive, is what I'm trying to say.
Think about it rationally, right? Think about the pioneer spirit, right? You're coming from, you're going from some shtetl in Eastern Europe, you're going from some village in Italy, or fill in the blank, right? You're literally crossing an ocean to effectively an uninhabited land. You've got to have a hope, you have to have a natural intrinsic hope or optimism to be willing to travel so far away from home, from everything you know and hold dear, in some cases you're going across the sort of Great Plains, where you're going to probably have your head stoved in by some Native American tribe. Like, to almost near certain death, you've got to have absolute will. You have to be a bit of a nutter,
yeah.
And you need to have a positivity and an optimism that things will be better on the other side. So I think that there is something intrinsic about the American psyche that just comes from that sort of natural pioneer spirit.
But they all believe in it though, don't they? They all believe, you know, it's the American dream. Whereas, you know, don't you say we must have maybe gone wrong at some stage. Maybe this, you know, people, we thought someone else will do it for me.
Yeah.
You know, someone else will, you know, Britain was the greatest, you know, country in the world at one stage, you know, it's controlled,
but Britain always used to have even in battles, right? Waterloo, right? If we talk about the Battle of Waterloo, you know, Britain hired German mercenaries to win that battle, you know, like
entrepreneurial,
you know,
at least.
Yeah, very entrepreneurial, yeah, it was resourceful, right? I don't know, like, I don't want to be negative, like, it's frustrating because I don't really want to be negative. I sort of felt like, you know, like I feel like 4 or 5 years ago, just pre-COVID, even in 21, there was this real surge of optimism. Everything had great momentum. Things were going in the right direction. And, you know that we have so much to be grateful for in the UK right now. We've got there's a lot of, you know, we have so many good things. It just seems that, you know, the people that have run the country, and it, you know, blue and red, they just seem to be experts at shooting themselves in the foot continuously. So
yeah, they're very good at screwing things up. I think that's for sure. I think, like you said, it doesn't feel like it's anything that's particularly difficult to fix, or it's going to take a long time to fix. But it feels like there's just a mentality issue and a positivity that's lacking. Maybe you're the guy.
Yeah, I don't know. I think less X, more LinkedIn, hey? let's turn it back a bit more to business. We've seen a specialist lender be exposed by an Al Jazeera expose about the laundering of money. Elites of an Asian government or former elites of an Asian government. I won't name them for obvious reasons. But have you ever been approached to help launder some money for someone or something similarly nefarious?
I wish I could sit here and tell you that, yes, there's this, you know, great story I've got.
I mean, if not, do you know of people who have had that kind of tap on the shoulder?
I certainly know of one situation where a lender was essentially encouraging someone to give them loan to own loans.
Okay.
With a long-term goal of having a setup abroad to acquire those properties. I think it did come out at one stage. There is a bit of information online. Uh-huh. Like you, I can't say who it was, but there was a bit of information online. I think it did quite well to cover it up.
And they're still operating that lender?
Yeah, they're still operating.
Okay.
And I see terms sometimes they give out to clients. I look at them and just think, it's obvious. I mean, you wouldn't go near this. If I sent the same loan to you, you'd probably just send me some laughing emojis in response. just go like, what is this pile of shite? And I want nothing to do with it. And, you know, you see the terms go out of them. I mean, you know, I'm talking about allowing clients to, you know, service loans that are just like...
completely unserviceable.
Like 900 grand, 50 grand a month. You're just thinking, where's that coming from? It's not let yet. Okay, so where's that coming from? But it's fine because it's you know, it's almost a mechanism in place to hope that client trips up. But I think the difficulty you have is sometimes clients are in those positions.
Yeah.
I've done loans like that in terms of said to the client, look, this lender is not going to have your best interests at heart. You better make sure you don't miss a payment and you repay them on time because it won't go well for you otherwise, you know. That's your choice. There are no other options for you. And unfortunately, sometimes you're backed into that position.
I mean, do you
sadly, no one's asked me to launder any money. Yeah. Well, they have, and I'm just not going to tell you.
No. do you think that there are a lot of instances of people at other brokers just jamming clients into lenders just for this, even though it's not the right loan for that? They're not the right lender or not the right loan for that client, just because, frankly, the proc's good and and they need to get paid.
I think there's also a lot of instances where brokers get overly greedy, where they are doing exactly what you're saying, which is jamming people into loans that probably aren't the best product for them, but potentially they, get paid more money by that lender, or, there's whatever there might be driving them to make that decision. I had one recently where a client came to me and he said, "Oh, look, I've got these terms from this lender. I looked at the terms and I saw it, like, you've done it for as long as we have, you very quickly can recognize whose terms look like what and what color border they have around the table in the email." You go, "Well, I know who that is." So I said to the client, in an honest conversation, I said, "Look, I know the lender is the best lender for you, but the broker's trying to rip you off. Like, it's a simple, straightforward loan. They're trying to charge you a fee. They're also trying to get a higher proc fee because I could tell by the rate." I said, "Look, if you're happy, let me get terms from them and I'll come back to you." Fast forward, I got them the terms, cheaper rate, blah, blah. And then the client's business partner felt bad. So he went back to the original broker and said, this is
what's happened.
This is what happened. So, quick, lo and behold, their application fee and offer fee and all these things started dropping away and they kind of matched it. Which I just thought was wrong. So we basically ended up doing it pretty much for free. Yes, am I a bit spiteful? Was I a bit spiteful? Yes, probably. But I don't think you deserve the chance to win that business if you went into it with that mentality in the first place. I think I think the industry could probably do with some more regulation in those aspects. But I also think it's, logistically talking about achieving that is near impossible.
It's quite tricky, isn't it? Yeah. I think the standard position at the moment is that there's effectively proc needs to be fully disclosed. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of fallout at the moment on the motor finance, the vehicle yeah. finance. Side of things. I didn't realize that up to I was reading that up to 70% of the entire lender margin on a lot of these car loans was being paid to brokers in undisclosed backhanders. I mean, that's nuts.
So, and you can still do some unsecured business loans now.
Yeah.
Where you get commission up to, I don't quite mean on it, but 10, 8. It certainly was 10%. But it is disclosed to the client, but you have that sliding scale of where the lender says, "Look, the more you make, the more we'll make."
Yeah.
So it's not like it's with a prop fee and you say to me, "Like, if you want to charge 5% arrangement fee, we'll pay it all to you." Not that you do, but that in theory, they will say, "Well, if you want 5%, we want 4%. So it goes from 3% to 9%. And it's, like you said, the motor industry. I think one thing, going back to business, one thing Phil always said to me, and he was very, very good on compliance, not necessarily boring compliance, but just making sure that you'd done a good job, was when you were looking at all this, car finance stuff, this PI insurance, he said, mortgages and, certainly consumer mortgages, so buy to lets in personal name, stuff like that, it will be next. And I think it will, it just makes sense. I think the limited company stuff is obviously always going to be very difficult. But I think some lenders in the bridging space who are doing bridging loans to, people's individual names who only own one asset, I think you've got to be very careful of what pain could be around the corner.
Yeah. I think that there's, I think the last 15 years, there've probably been a number of non-regulated bridging lenders that have lent against clients' main reses. They might have tried to do the old business purposes trick, lending to
third party
legal charge. That kind of thing. I mean, we always, we always like to operate when it comes to regs, we always like to operate within both the spirit and the letter of the law. I think there'd probably been plenty of lenders, I think, who have have lent directly to the client in the personal name against the main res, knowing that it was their main res, but just hope, you know, winging a prayer, hot market, she'll be all right, mate, type of thing. And, you know, they won't get caught out. I imagine there will be a few bridge lenders at the moment who are probably sweating because market's not that great right now. And they'll have maybe written a few regulated loans knowingly or unknowingly, and knowing that they can't get out of them.
I think interestingly, you know, you were talking earlier about margins, how tight some margins are for some bridge lenders. You only need one of those loans to go wrong and your funding line to turn around to you and go, you know, talk me through how you decided this, and then to turn around and say, well, no, this is, you know, this is your penalty for doing that. Yeah. And very quickly, that whole business, you know, is in a spot of trouble. But at the same time, I think lenders are so desperate to get a slice of the market that they'll do these sorts of things. They'll take a third party charge. They'll, you know, accept, sign this waiver that says you don't live there.
Yeah.
Even though the value has been over and I've got pictures of your, you know, the kitchen where I can see your family portrait. sign this waiver and kind of we'll go. But, you know, I think there's so many people so desperate for a slice of the pie that they're doing it.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of like, you know, bad loans and funding lines, you know, that someone I know, quite a well-established lender, I think they took a £20 million hit on a commercial asset. I think it's like a marina or something like that. And you think, wow, because that's not coming out of your whole warehouse line. That's coming out of your equity. Mm-hmm. And you're like, wow. And yet somehow, what amazes me is that this business is still lending, it's still carrying on, still trucking. I'm like, if I lost £20 million worth of equity on one deal,
yep,
I'd just be like, hit the red button, we're done. You know, it just amazes me that, you know, like we talked about the guy who was part of the Al Jazeera expose. What I find remarkable about a lot of some of my peers, it's just like how Teflon they are. Just amazing. Yep. Like next day tweeting like nothing even happened, you know, like vote for us in this awards.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of,
I mean, hats off to them, but Jesus Christ, like I have shame, you know.
Yeah, there is a lot of smoke and mirrors, you know, in this industry. You know, I remember going for a deal with one lender who, you know, pulled out on the day before completion. And at the same time, you know, they're banging on LinkedIn and paying for adverts in our, you know, industry newsletters and stuff we get through, you know, the magazines and stuff like that, you know, about how great they are, this, that, and the other. But one thing I've always preferred doing is dealing with lenders who at least have principal equity in deals.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, A, there's very little care. And B, you know, you don't really deal with a decision maker, or you're not dealing even with a business that is the decision maker. You know, this deal I have with these guys, I quickly worked out that they just took all these inquiries on and they would just wing it last minute to the funding line and hope that they would do the deal. Never seen it before. And you just start to think, these are, you know, you may think that you're just trying to make some money, but these are some people's lives. You know, it does matter to them that they're not going to get a bridging loan to repay the app. Defaulted finance that then has massive charges like that, you know, might be a 5% charge running over, etc. So there probably needs to be a bit more accountability there.
Yeah, the fun, you know, like pulling out the day of completion. For me, it's like we've never done it, like literally never done it, and it's the thing that I fear most, like the idea that we can't, you know, like I love doing deals. You know, obviously I'm not operationally at the front end doing most of the business, but I'm, you know, I'm seeing it. But the idea for me that you know, we get to the day before drawdown and we're like, really sorry, but the money's not there. No, mate, I could just, for me, that's like probably my biggest like fear, biggest horror. I just never want to do that. Like, look, deals sometimes fall over, right? That's part and part of the industry. But you can't drag someone, take someone all the way to completion and then not perform.
And just hope.
Yeah, you know.
But does it boil back to the fact that people are so desperate to get a slice of this market and this space, the short-term lending space, that they're willing to take those risks? And I think also people know that, you know, someone asked me to do an article recently for something, about calling people out on LinkedIn for, you know, not delivering. But I think even brokers, you know, you're very scared to do that. I did it once to a lender without naming them, and then got an email saying they would repay the client's legal fees, valuation fees, etc. But I'd already asked for that before and they refused to do it. But only once I did the post saying, you know, if you take it down, I said, I won't take it down, but I won't name you. But it's, you know, there's maybe not enough, you know, whatever it might be, Trustpilot type reviews on people and sort of honest feedback and stuff like that. It's a bit of the Wild West.
Yeah. Well, I think there does need to be a degree of accountability that I think it's appropriate when it's egregious. I think when sometimes, a lot of the time, clients don't have the right professionals, like don't have the right solicitors advising them, and the client solicitor gets a long list of, it gets the CPSC list, even though most of the answers are not applicable, no or not applicable, right? But you know, they're Mr. Khan above the chicken cottage solicitor, and he's used to doing resi conveyancing, and then he's getting paid another 300 quid over and above that to do a commercial conveyance for a bridging lender, and he just goes, you know, and he's just like, he can't be fucked with it, right? And he just goes, and he says to the client, I've received the bridging lender's inquiry list, it's ridiculous, it's too long, you know, they're being completely unreasonable. They're not. They're genuinely not. It's just, you're just
used to a normal, very straightforward conveyancing job.
Do you know what I mean? Like, so, and deals can fall over like because of things like that. It's like, it's the example that you said, like where the client's literally there, ready to complete on an acquisition of the property, about to go into their notice period, and potentially going to lose their deposit, and you know, the bridge lender or the development lender hasn't performed, or the buy-to-let lender hasn't performed. That's a completely different kettle of fish, in my opinion. Let's talk about stuff that's a bit more fun. You talked about your love of golf, and you've also developed some interesting friendships at the golf club that you're a member at. Some famous ex-pro footballers. How much golf are you playing these days, and is it genuinely a business benefit? Are you getting a lot out of it?
Not enough is the answer.
Yeah.
Never enough. That's not business. There's never enough golf. I think, you know, I'm a sucker for warm weather, so I love playing golf in the warm weather. I think one brilliant thing about the game of golf is how many examples can you find where you spend a period of time of around four hours with someone? And it's also not constantly with someone. You don't get bored of each other's company. Because, you know, you walk off in different directions and do your own thing, but you really get to interact with that person about life, business, sport, other sport, whatever it might be. To me, it's the greatest game. You'll never conquer it. You know, Tiger Woods never conquered it. Doesn't care who, you know, no one has. You never would. You can always do better. And I don't use golf as a mechanism to generate revenue, I think is the easiest way to say it, but I do use it as a mechanism to grow long-lasting relationships with people.
Which I guess indirectly leads to
the second part.
With the friendships you've made with some of the sort of the ex-footballers that you've got to know, have you got to meet any other interesting people or celebrities or sports people? Have you got to meet sort of, you know, maybe some former Arsenal idols by any chance? Anyone you looked up to as a kid?
You know what? The Arsenal part is probably the bit I'm lacking. But the one thing I would say is that, you know, you never judge a book by its cover.
Yeah.
There's certain people who I've been lucky enough to spend some time with who I detested when I watched them play.
And I know exactly who you're talking about.
Sport.
And he actually did a very nice thing for the props last year. So we thank him for that.
And when you actually get to know that person, you actually realize, you know, what a great guy he is, what a great family he has around him. I mean, my God, what you can learn about competitive nature from these guys is, you know, it is insane. Could be table tennis, snooker, whatever it might be, the obsession for winning, it's amazing to see. But I think what it's done is it gives you kind of credibility to deal with probably some people that are quite confidential in this space.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been lucky enough to deal with, you know, quite a few, you know, entertainment celebrities, music celebrities, sports celebrities in terms of, you know, looking after their property finance requirements. And I think that has opened doors for that, or it just, what it shows is that, you know, if that person trusts you, you're clearly quite confidential. Yeah. You know, you're not going to go and tell people, I did so-and-so's mortgage, yeah, or I know how much so-and-so really makes each month, all that sort of thing. So that's, you know, that's been great.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. Just going to start the wind down now. So closing tradition we have for guests is that to ask them, you know, ask them what they would advise their younger selves, knowing what they do now. I guess if you were to look back at, you know, you can choose the age, whether it's 16, 18, 21, but if you were to give yourself some advice, knowing what you do now, when you were, you know, 21, what would you say to yourself and why?
I think I'd tell myself to start earlier. You know, I think you always think that, you know, I could learn more, you know, before I go out on my own, or, you know, maybe I'm not ready to do this yet. But I think what you very, very quickly find out is I felt like a very young entrepreneur at one stage when I started a business. Before, you know, I even start to feel like I'm not that younger entrepreneur now, or I'm not that younger business owner now. And, you know, what could have been if I started earlier? And I've only learned what I've learned through experience of getting things wrong. And so getting on with it and doing it and working out how to fail, how to get things wrong, I think is, you know, a great thing. Would I have gone to university looking back at it? No. Obviously that took me down a path which takes me to where I am today. So it's hard to, you know, totally rule it out as a waste of time or what have you. But I think it would just be just to believe in yourself and get on with things sooner.
Yeah.
And don't wait.
That's great advice. Great advice. Yeah. I think a lot of people would look at that, look at themselves and go, yeah, what am I waiting for?
Yeah.
Whether they take action or not, it's entirely up to them. Callum, it's been a pleasure. As always, it was great to spend time with you. Without wanting to repeat ourselves, could you just let people know where they can find you on the internet if they want to get in touch, if they want to have a chat, want to have a game of golf, or if they want to talk residential or commercial mortgage?
Yeah, absolutely. We are on social channels, Portway Finance on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook as well, but on the internet it'll be portway-finance.co.uk. My website, my email's on the website. Feel free to get in touch. I love speaking to people about all sorts of different things. So that'd be great. And thank you for having me. I appreciate your time.
It's been an absolute pleasure. As many of you know, but I'll repeat it anyway, my name is Michael Dean. I'm at property_funder. You can find me on the various social platforms there. Thanks also to Avonmore Capital, the show sponsor, and the series sponsor, J3 Advisory. We'll talk to you again on the next one. All right, thank you and goodbye.